Welcome to the Property Couch, where each week you get to listen to two of Australia's leading property experts. Bryce Holdaway, co-host of Location, Location, Location Australia on Foxtel's Lifestyle Channel, and Ben Kingsley, Chair of Property Investors Council of Australia and the 2014 and 2015 Property Investment Advisors of the Year.
All right, folks, you're on the Property Couch for each week. Ben and I bring an insider's guide to property finance and money management. Hello, mate.
G'day, mate. How are you?
Very good. Special guest today.
Oh, I know. Return.
Special guest today.
Return. Oh, I lost my voice.
Yeah, she's a very shy girl, though, so we might have to encourage her.
Yeah, she doesn't like to talk much.
And, we should introduce you. Nicole, welcome back. Nicole Fade, how are you?
I am fantastic. Mm. Excellent. Thank you, boys. Great to be back.
Our settlement specialist.
Our settlement. So, but before we deep dive, Ben, I'm just going to quickly do Mindset Minute.
Yes, please.
And today I was listening to podcasts from our friends Tom and John. Panos,
yes,
John McGrath.
$1 agent, great
Tom
podcast.
Tom goes, if you're going, a new beginning is often disguised as a painful ending.
Mm.
And I think there was, you know, sometimes it doesn't feel like the right thing at the time.
Yeah.
But when you get through it, you've realised it was actually a really good thing to go through.
Yeah.
And John followed on from that and he says, mate, if you're going through hell, keep going. That's no place to stop. Yeah. So just a shout out to anyone who is potentially going through some stuff. Mm-hmm. But if it's financial, Ben,
yep.
Sometimes the new financial beginning is often disguised mm-hmm. as a painful ending. So there you go. Thanks to Tom and John for that. But Nicole, we spoke to you last time. So for our listeners, Ben.
Yes.
We've had Nicole on before.
We have. Episode 107.
I prepped
because you just told me that.
Yeah, that's right.
Being downloaded 22,000 times, 21,000 by Ben.
Really? Yeah. You don't want to hear your voice that much?
No, Jack. Yeah, we listen to it.
We know each other very well. That's why this banter is.
So we're not going into backstory today, Ben. Because we went into backstory on that episode.
Yes.
So, and it's well worth listening.
Yeah.
Find out what happened to Nicole's mentor. That's worth going back and listening to. And so there's some good stuff. But today we thought we would get you on, Nicole, because I reckon conveyancing is one of those mysterious things that people who buy a property, they just go through. Mm. They hand the contract over to you guys, close their eyes, and just hope.
Hope for the best.
Hope for the best that it settles. So what I thought we'd do today is maybe just take away some of that mystery,
mm-hmm.
but also talk about what you see in your industry that most people wouldn't even think about. When it comes to conveyancing, what are the top things,
the issues
that people need to think about when they're going through this process? Because in a perfect world, you get a file, you get the settlement done, you close the file, ask the client for a testimonial, everyone's happy. But it often doesn't happen like that. So we want to find out, we want to peel back the layer and see some of the challenges that you go through on a weekly basis.
Mm-hmm.
Sound okay?
Easy.
All right.
Let's get into it. What's number one?
Number one, and I'm going to start at the most expensive to fix.
Let's
start with title issues, boundary discrepancies. Mm-hmm. So conveyancing is really the process of transferring title deeds from one person to another, doing searches along the way.
Yes.
The contract, everything is underpinned by one document. It's called the Certificate of Title or Certificates of Title. And the contractual obligation on a vendor is to just deliver to you an unencumbered certificate of title at settlement. And sometimes there is a house atop that land mm-hmm. on that title.
Yes.
Or sometimes there's a block of flats mm-hmm. or there's not, or it's a car park. So the title is the most important document.
Mm.
Because that's actually what you're paying for. You're not paying for the house as such.
Mm.
That just is an added bonus.
That's often a surprise for people, isn't it? Because mm-hmm. If someone's an owner-occupier and they move out and it's a pigsty, they're often like, well, how do they get away with that? And like what you just said is it's not. They're only making sure that you get transfer of the land, not transfer of the building.
Mm. It all comes back to the contract. What's the contractual obligation imposed on the vendor?
Mm.
The vendor has to deliver you a title, amongst other things, but they need to give you a certificate of title. People think that you get keys with the house as well. There's no contractual obligation for a vendor to give you keys at settlement.
But
that is an easy fix. That's a $200 locksmith job. If you don't get all the keys.
So what we're really talking about here is things like encroachments, adverse possessions.
Discrepancies
in those boundaries.
Absolutely.
Because you're thinking, wait a minute, I'm getting 804 square metres of dirt, but all of a sudden now it's 786 square metres of dirt because someone's encroached, the fence line's not there. So that's where the biggest issues are.
How often, rough percentage, would that happen?
On houses, so it's less of an issue with units because you buy airspace. But on houses, I would say they're those slips and slithers of land, you know, the discrepancies would be less than 5%, but they account for the biggest expense to fix.
All right.
Absolutely.
So how do we fix it?
Yeah, so what's the cost to rectify? Let's give the listeners a bit of an idea in terms of, so we're going, you and I, you're selling, I'm buying.
Yep.
I think I'm getting 17 metres wide and it's
16.9. Yeah.
Okay, there's 10 centimetres there right down the side of the block that goes for, what, 50 metres?
Mm-hmm.
So there's...
So the calculation of that on a square metre basis, Ben, is...
50 square metres.
Okay, 50 square metres. We got that right.
Is it 50 times? Yeah, that's pretty
out of how many? How many is the total block?
Oh, okay, so let's call it 500. Keep it easy.
Okay. Okay.
So it's a narrow block.
So that's 10%.
It's not 10% discrepancy.
I'm trying to work out
the... It would be 500. 5 square metres.
Yeah, exactly. It would be a lot more than that.
Let's say it's 50 square metres of a total block of 500 square metres.
Yes.
So we then know that it's a 10% discrepancy.
Yes.
So under the general conditions of a contract, any misdescription in title is permitted and it's not a breach of contract or a defect in title by the vendor. So the purchaser's rights and recourses against a vendor don't necessarily exist in the contract. They might exist at common law.
Right.
So the common law is called a flight and booth rule, which is 5%, the 5% theory, that anything more than a 5% discrepancy of the overall land size should give rise or rights to the purchaser to pursue that for damages against the vendor through the common law and the courts.
Yep. Righty-o.
So that is available to them. But anything under 5%.
So 49 square metres? No.
Well, it's the cost to pursue that. Mm. So you need lawyers involved, you need surveyors, so you need to establish. So you'll spend $4,000 or $5,000 straight up.
Mm.
And then you've got to go to the lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
And so the onus is on you to prove that there's a discrepancy. And then it could go into adverse possession. How long has that land, has that boundary been, say, pushed out into someone else's land?
Yes.
Do you have the rights to claim it under adverse possession?
Yep.
15 years exclusive occupation or 30 years if you can get it. But there's a really big process for adverse possession, and it's very expensive, between $10,000 and $20,000. But you can't adversely possess against, say, council land, so laneways out the back.
Yeah.
That's no longer allowed. Now, when you go and inspect a property, you go to the open for inspection, you can see a nice big backyard with a huge lush garden sitting across, you know, the back of the house, and you think that you are getting 300 square metres or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, a depth of 30 metres. But the title plan says that it's not 30 metres, it's 25.
Mm.
And so you're 5 metres short across and 3 metres whatever.
Yep.
So we had a case in Brunswick where it was...
I was going to say, this is a good example here.
Yeah, that's one, but there was one in Brunswick which was a laneway, and the courtyard had an established garden, pavers and the like. Council found out about it because a neighbour before the auction had notified them, and that there was an encroachment onto the laneway.
Yeah.
And it was a council laneway, so they came out, put a notice on the property after the day of contract, after the day of auction.
Wow. Gosh.
So it became the purchaser's liability and responsibility to fix,
which
that one was around about $45,000-$50,000, because the vendor solicitor was aware and put a clause in the contract saying you can't make any claim against the vendor. But also the council said you have to reinstate it to its natural position.
Yeah,
and that was a laneway of bluestone cobblestones from 100 years ago.
Gosh.
And it's really hard because they don't mine those. No. They don't manufacture those bluestones anymore. So it was really expensive to go back into, you know, sort of an antique world and to replicate it. Yeah. But council were adamant. It was City of Yarra.
Wow.
Yeah. That was a property enrichment.
So because there was a clause in that contract, you couldn't go back to the vendor?
No. And it was also, but it wasn't more than 5% either. But it was also a case of the council issued the notice for the encroachment after the auction, after the purchaser had signed. So it really was
really
unfortunate.
Tough deal for the buyer. So when you see clauses like that in the contract, would you request to strike them out? 100%.
I would. Well, no, because they've put them in, so the vendor won't agree to it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's why they put it in the first place. These clients were first-time buyers. Mm. It was a $900,000 property in Richmond. They didn't get a contract review.
God.
So we couldn't inform them and give them advice
that's
prior.
The point. Yeah.
And it was a really sad situation for them because they've just gone into their first home ownership and they can't get funding for the rectification of the title because it was 50,000.
Yeah.
Somewhere between 30,000 and 70,000 is what they'd been quoted.
Yeah, yeah.
So we just took the midpoint and said, and it's 50 grand.
That's the
annoying part. Find that cash.
Like, so, yeah, so 30 to 50 to spend on a kitchen, that'd be fine. But just on rectification, that means
to lose
nothing.
Your land, to lose your courtyard
as well.
It's
heartbreaking.
So, but I want to go back to that point. I mean, if I'm seeing that in a contract, then something's got to be up. Like, you know, if I don't want that.
But you're reading it. You're assuming that the average punter is going to read a contract.
That, yeah.
But they're not. Because it's written in legalese. They're not legal experts.
No.
It's like me going to a mechanic and the mechanic telling me all about the carburetor or whatever it's called.
Yeah.
I've got no idea. I will glaze over and probably fall asleep.
Yeah. It's like when and you go up to the guy at the airline checkout and you go, oh, I'm going to miss my flight. Can I get the next one? And they go, no, you haven't got a flexi flight. No. Can you read your terms and conditions?
Yeah.
No, I just ticked the box and moved on.
Yeah. Because it's in 3 font and it goes for 25 pages.
Yeah. Okay. So that's an interesting one.
Yeah.
So land disputes.
Well, hang on. The takeaway is absolutely.
Oh.
Okay. Solution.
Do not buy without having your.
Yeah, but that's the whole takeaway of today's episode.
Mate. Yeah.
We're going to be.
But it's also about, you know, you're responsible for your own decisions, so you can't go blame someone for you not doing your due diligence.
Yeah.
So it's buyer beware. And you know, anyone that's over the age of 18 and is of sound mind, they are responsible for their own decisions. So then you just go and engage the appropriate finance people, buyers advocates and the like. But you should be advised to go and measure that property first. So the solution and the takeout from this is measure the land so you know. And it won't be accurate, but you're allowed a couple of centimetres here and there. It doesn't really matter. Just make sure you're buying what ostensibly is what you're paying for, because the other case study that I'd referenced was a property in Yarraville or Seddon or something like that. It was 23%
deficient. Land.
So they'd pushed a fence out by and it encompassed, it had a little shed on there, and it was called excess land. So there was probably a right available to them to claim it, and it still would have cost the client probably between $5,000 and $15,000. She didn't want to pursue that. She didn't measure before she signed. She lived interstate, so she didn't come down and measure and identify this. But because it was Yarraville and it's a smaller sort of property and land is valuable out there, they had estimated $150,000 loss of land.
Wow, in value.
Yeah.
Incredible. Incredible.
So, yeah.
So obviously, we now, just for the listeners' benefit, Victorian law, land titles is state-based titles based, so we're obviously talking about
Victoria,
but in terms of, they're very similar across most. So you can take these messages in every state and still do the fundamentals right.
Mm-hmm.
Get the contract vetted, you know, go out and measure the block.
Have you transacted in your career outside of Victoria?
We're not allowed to. We're not licensed.
So you haven't been working in any other state?
No.
So someone, because this is a question that comes up regularly, someone's in New South Wales and they go, I want my New South Wales person to do it for me. They're eventually engaging you anyway, aren't they? So the New South Wales person, it's effectively an extra layer of cost if the person insists on using their local-based conveyancer, isn't it?
Yeah, we've had a few situations like that. Clients in New South Wales, and they'll have legal representatives up there, but they don't understand. Lawyers can cross the jurisdictions.
Yep.
Conveyancers can't.
Yep.
And we're happy to just stick local. There's enough work around here.
Yeah.
And if we want to be experts in one thing,
we
want to know it inside and out.
Well, I had a client ring last night and says, oh, I want, hey, Ben, can you put me in contact with a Sydney-based lawyer conveyancer? I said, no worries at all, because based in Melbourne. And can you put me in contact with a mortgage broker that's Sydney-based? I'm like, no, your mortgage broker doesn't have to be in the state. They can be here, but isn't it funny how it's just some people don't know, and you just assume that they know that, you know, lending is national, but, you know, obviously Titles Act is state or territory-based in terms of what it looks like. So that's number one. What's number two? What's another big common issue?
Oh, chattels, fixtures and fittings.
Yeah.
They're called goods under the contract,
and
they used to be called fixtures and fittings. They mean the same thing.
Yeah.
It is, they are those items, appliances that are annexed permanently, usually, to the property, your stoves, light fittings, window furnishings, and things like that. Again, what's the contractual obligation on the vendor? Well, they retain the risk until settlement, usually under the general conditions, and that always prevails.
Yep.
They hold the risk until the day of settlement. However, fair wear and tear is accepted, and your interpretation of what's fair and fair wear and tear can be vastly different to the purchaser, because the purchaser is in a highly emotioned state because they're paying a huge amount of money, and they walk in and they see that an air conditioner is not working.
Or little Johnny's been riding his, you know, Pee Wee 50 up and down the hallway.
Yeah.
That's not fair wear.
So our idea of fair wear and tear with, you know, 5, 6 and 7 year olds is different to the first home buyer who doesn't have any kids.
Exactly. Yeah. We had one property where the owner's son lived in the property and he wasn't a 5 or 6 year old. I think the 5 or 6 year old would have treated a little bit better, but he was a uni student, and so he had all of his mates around, and there was not a wall in a room that didn't have a massive hole in it.
Gosh.
I don't know what they were doing. But
post-contract?
Yeah.
Far out.
Yeah. So it's just that the chattels can be expensive to fix, but it also can be, we've had somewhere they've come out, air conditioner's not working.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a $2 solution at Bunnings. Go get yourself some batteries.
Mm. Yeah.
So when you're buying a property, you expect it to be in good working order, but unless you A, test it, B, listed in the contract that all of these items have been tested and are in good working order, then the vendor is going to come back and rely on the general conditions that state fair wear and tear is accepted. So, mate, it wasn't working to begin with. Can you prove otherwise? No, well, I didn't test it. I just thought that the air conditioner was working. I had one vendor who removed the wall-mounted AC, so left a hole in the plaster, and he said it was not hardwired, and therefore it was ornamental, and it was not a fixture because it was not permanently annexed. Oh. Now, that was my vendor client.
No longer working with him.
No longer working with him or anyone else associated with him, because I thought it was a very low act to do that to a purchaser. Yeah. But, you know, that's $2,000 that it cost that purchaser.
Yeah. And so other examples of that is when the vendors moved out a little early and they've said, all right, we'll do all the right thing. We'll turn all the power off and get everything. So the people come in for their final inspection 2 days out and no power's on.
Yeah.
And they go, well, we haven't tested the air conditioner. We haven't tested. So how do we know the ducted heating? It's like, that's difficult.
Yeah.
So ultimately getting all... When you're first looking at a property, you should be checking those things in terms of, you know, working order. So it's
well, you've given us a clause that says make sure they're in working repair. What's the word?
It's in good working order.
Good working order, yes.
And if anything has fallen into disrepair from the time of the contract to settlement, then the purchaser has the right to retain monies of the equivalent value to repair the works, and the parties agree to that.
Word for word.
Word for word. She knows her stuff. She knows her stuff.
There's a few more other words.
So there's a great example of the air conditioner not working. What about scratches and things like that? That general.
Yeah, well, we had one recently where the tiles were scratched.
Yeah.
because they'd used an abrasive substance to clean it when they were moving out.
Oh, Jif, good old Jif's done. They got the marble
there
tile.
There are about three or four tiles scratched.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, it's not a major issue for me. I don't really want to be hearing about tile scratches.
You love emails like that, don't you?
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, yeah.
It's good, you know, because it's all about trying to help the experience of the, like, for the client, you just want it to for them to have a seamless experience. But sometimes you have to push back on the client and go, come on, it's really, this is not a contractual issue. It's not a conveyancing issue. We had one last week. And the microwave starter button had bubbled. But operationally, it still worked. Mm. But the client wanted, you know, to know what the rights were.
The microwave's not fixed usually, so...
I know, and that's part of a furniture package.
They could take it if you want to.
Yeah, so, and it had just bubbled. So it's unsightly, yes, but there's nothing much you can do about it. Yeah. So you pick your battles. When you buy a property, if you are lucky... The vendor is going to act in good faith in the spirit of the contract and do the right thing by you.
Yep. But it's not always the case. And that's why we're talking about these issues.
Well, that's what I said here. When people get a building inspection, you've got to make sure they're not material. You know, you want major and minor.
Yes.
And majors, obviously, you make a determination on whether you're going to proceed or not.
Mm.
Or use it as a negotiating power.
Yeah.
But the minor is just a, it's just a, it's a maintenance list. It's telling you what your maintenance list is when you own it.
Yeah.
Not, you can't stop the, you can't stop the settlement on minor stuff.
No.
Because they go, well, I want the electrical cord connected. Well, it's as is.
Well, we've had people take light bulbs out. Like we know, you know, we used to do some work with the real estate dispute resolution, which is the, you know, the sort of consumer affairs here in Victoria. And Russell there would tell stories of people taking light bulbs out.
Mm.
Yeah.
Like 80 cent light bulbs.
Yeah.
And they'd take them away as well.
Yeah.
So you just got to understand that you're buying the land.
Mm. I think that's the key aha bit.
You are buying the land
and everything else that comes with it, it's a bonus.
Yeah.
And the vendor doesn't have to represent it any other way.
Yeah.
But like we don't want to freak people out completely. That's why you get good clauses written in. What a lot of people don't realise, that you can change the contract. You can make attempts to change it. You can put clause in there to protect you against things like that. So that's
the challenge in a really fast-paced market, because Ben's actually really absolutely right. But you've got a vendor who's got great property and three interested buyers
at auction, going to auction as well. Mm.
So there's two things, isn't it? If you're at auction, they either say yes or no, take it or leave it.
Yeah.
But if you're in a private treaty scenario, sometimes you've got to get the reasonable person middle, because you can like defend. Oh, I'm going to have all these clauses in and. They say, well, your contract's too hard. I'll take this one in a competitive scenario. So
I agree. It's difficult.
You got to be able to define critical, important, nice to do.
And that's the art of negotiation too, isn't it?
Mm.
Like that's also, you know, that's on previous podcasts we've talked about, you know, buyers, agents and what they can do. I mean, this is the whole point.
Mm.
You can't take your conveyancer and legal person to inspect every house with you and negotiate with every property. You then basically, that's part of all the moving parts that they put together to get value to sort of ensure that these horror stories don't come up. Interesting. What have we got next?
We have, so there's final inspection,
which
ties a little bit in with our chattels topic and the issues that we get with the fixtures and the fittings. But final inspection is not limited to just the chattels.
Mm.
So there are other things that can go wrong. House could burn down.
Mm. Mm.
Oops.
Mm. Have you had one of those?
Yeah, I've had two.
Two house burns down.
We've just had purchase or die before settlement and without a will, and now there's the estate's being contested and we on bought on reliance of our sale proceeds. So lots of things can happen in that short contract settlement period of 30, 60, 90 days.
Yep.
But final inspections are... that's probably along with the chattels, because it usually becomes evident to the buyer at the final inspection, which is your contractual right to do within 7 days preceding settlement. So you make an arrangement with the agent, you go out there and you don't like the condition of the property. It's dirty. Tough luck.
Mm. Yeah.
And I'll say that to you, but in a nice way.
Yeah,
you know, I'll sugarcoat it a little bit, but it is tough luck.
Yeah.
The This is where we spend a lot of our time in final inspection disputes.
Yep.
It is not part of the conveyancing process and our skills to what we have to do from a conveyancing point of view, because we are focusing on the title.
Yep.
So we will charge you extra for those disputes because they can be drawn out battles.
Yep.
And eventually the purchaser usually has to capitulate.
Mm.
Because under the general conditions, 24 to be precise, you the risk remains with the vendor. It's supposed to be in the same condition except for fair wear and tear, but the purchaser must, the settlement must proceed.
Yeah.
And then maybe there might be a right for the purchaser to retain some of the vendor's money under the conditions.
Yep.
Purchaser matches that money. It sits in trust pending resolution. And there's no mediation process for that, so let your lawyers do that and chew up all of the money. And then you have to settle under protest. So the
what's the point in saying it's at the vendor's risk if they've got no risk then?
I think because substantial damage, things like that, it needs to remain, the risk needs to remain with the vendor until they pass to you, because you at the moment under contract have an equitable interest in this property.
Mm-hmm.
Once your transfer registers, it becomes a legal interest. Mm. So that's irrefutable, undeniable ownership of that property.
Yes.
So in that period, it's grey.
Mm.
So we'll always say to our clients, take out some insurance in the meantime. Tell your insurer you're in a contract period as a purchaser. So what if there's a double up on insurance? This is exactly what we had when a house burnt down in Airport West.
Yeah, yeah.
Both parties had insurance. The two insurers met, they discussed, and they worked out who pays what for the complete rebuild.
And that's a good outcome.
Leave it up to the insurers.
Yeah, the moment you sign that contract, you've got equitable interest in that property.
So register it by purchaser's caveat as well.
So what are some of the costs? Like, I mean, you've got a couple of examples. Let's talk about those examples where rubbish, people leaving, you know, things behind. Tell me about that.
That was a...
Sorry, register by purchaser's caveat, you just said. What does that mean?
That registers your interest as a purchaser on title to the world that you, under a contract, have an interest in that property, an equitable interest. Mm. It means it will prevent and prohibit the vendor going and dealing with that property and going and getting another mortgage, for example, refinancing it without you being informed. But if there is someone that comes out of the woodwork and says, oh, this guy owes me money, oh, he's just sold his property, I'm going to slap a caveat on.
Mm.
Ours will trump theirs. But if ours is not on there, it will become someone's problem to deal with.
Yeah.
But family law caveats are a different scenario. So when spouses separate and things like that. But there are some caveats that can trump a purchaser's one. But it's the best risk management for $250, whatever it costs. It's the best risk management.
And the timing of that is how long after they sign?
As soon as your contract is unconditional.
Yeah. Oh, unconditional.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Good tip.
Really. That's a ripper. And what's that called again? Just to
remember. Purchaser's caveat.
Purchaser's caveat insurance.
No, purchaser's caveat.
Just purchaser's caveat.
Yep. And your conveyancer, good your conveyancer legal rep does that.
Does that.
And they should recommend it. You know, to you.
So I've used the caveat as a negotiating chip before, but I've never actually followed through on it.
Yeah.
But it worked. The bluff worked, but I've never actually had to follow through on it.
Yeah. Well, so they have their place, and you know, most of the time settlements go through without a problem. But if you have someone slap a caveat on your property 5 minutes before a settlement, it's different with PEXA now because there's an earlier cutoff time.
Yep.
But in the paper world, you might have someone come in an hour before settlement, lodge a caveat against the vendor. You're not aware of it because you've already done your due diligence title searches and you know it doesn't have a caveat. You hand over your money to the vendor and then the purchaser goes to register their transfer and they can't because the vendor's got a caveat on there and they haven't handed over withdrawal. That person is claiming $50,000. That's your problem to deal with as a purchaser, your problem, your financial risk and your financial liability.
Just to explain for the listeners, a caveat is effectively like a creditor's position to get access to money. So
it's like a clamp on your car. You know, when they clamp the car when you can't drive away from it, it's the same deal.
Yeah. So when the ranger comes out and clamps the car, you can't use your car. So you got to someone's got to pay that before they'll come and unlock it before you can use it. So again, this is why getting professional help at the very best level, not the cheap level, because the good, you know, the good ones do the deeper dives, they do the proper due diligence, they put the proper legal frameworks around it, as opposed to someone who's just cookie cutting and just doing the bare minimum to transfer that. And then it's not their problem. They just wash their hands of it if something goes wrong. A great conveyancer or solicitor will do all of that extra lifting, you know, dotting I's and crossing T's, and will basically put you in a better position that if a dispute does arise, you're well prepared for it. Whereas those ones who are very cheap, and this is why in our business, we only deal with high-end conveyancers and solicitors, because when it does, maybe on 5% of the time, it goes wrong, it goes sour, then you just know you're in a really strong position that they've got your back, as opposed to the cheapies. That's someone else's problem. I've done my bit. You go and sort that out with your lawyers. And it's horrible. So very, very good.
Well, the challenge for some purchasers, they get a list from of all searches and, that are optional, and they, you know, which ones should I do? And quite often, without an explanation like you've just provided, it's hard for people
to know
which ones to tick and which ones to let go.
But our first letter...
you can over-insure and you can under-insure.
Absolutely. Mm. And we've got our first letter of advice is... roughly about 6, 7, 8 pages long, depending on what the property is. Yeah. And then there's all the attachments.
Yeah.
But it will give you in layman's terms, these are all of the things. This is the process from now until settlement. These are the things you should do, which are non-conveyancing related. Yeah. Final inspection, utilities, give them 7 days notice, do this, do that. And so we will give you the explanation of what a purchaser's caveat is and title insurance for the for life. But you opt in. And then sometimes clients will tell us and tick every box, I want all of these things. We'll ring up and say, well, you don't actually need all of those things. Oh, okay, I just thought I should tick it.
Good. But it's good that they're starting with that, and it's good that you're giving them some professional advice back. And sort of work back from that. Because I think really it should be, if you're putting it on the list, I think I need it, unless you tell me otherwise. Because there's that classic case of the flooding. I'll talk about that on final
inspection. The Hampton property?
Yeah, because that's a ripper. But that wasn't your client, was it?
Yeah, ours was the purchaser.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
I thought that was just something I read in the paper.
No, this was... the outcome was good in the end, and it was a great result for our people, but it also helps that they were very calm, logical, sensible purchasers.
Yeah.
2.4 million, expats moving back over here, buy this beautiful property.
Welcome home.
Yeah. Welcome home. And the just before settlement, there's a sort of an area that's sort of outdoor but covered in, and the a pipe burst in one of the walls and then flooded, and there was water ingress under the very expensive floorboards. And so all of the oak had to be ripped up, and it was a really big, you know, insurance claim. So the vendor actually lodged the insurance, and then part of that, I believe it's in the legislation, that you're allowed to assign your rights under a claim if it's under contract to the incoming buyer, so then they have the opportunity to deal with you. So the vendor, prior to settlement, advised us of the damage, advised us that here's the claim that I've lodged, here's the correspondence from our insurer.
Nice.
Could you please still settle? And so we sat down and we gave a lot of time to our client, and we discussed about all of the risks and the opportunities and the like, and you know what we could do here. So they ended up settling, and the insurance money came through. I think it was possibly about 3 months after settlement, but there was they got the boards replaced and everything like that. And because it wasn't in the main part of the house, it didn't affect their quality of living. So that was a good outcome because you're dealing with...
$50,000 in damages.
Yeah, and you're dealing with professionals as well at $2.4 million. Yeah. The debris that was left in the house, that was actually brought in by the vendor out in the Wild West. Can I say that? Was that in Werribee or Hoppers Crossing?
Yeah, but you can say that. I thought you were talking about my hometown of Perth then.
Oh, no. That is definitely Wild West. But Wild West statewide.
We've got colour TV and internet in Perth now.
Do you have Sunday trading?
Okay, so the debris story was the Wild West, not the leafy east.
And right so the agent and the vendor were annoyed that our purchaser didn't facilitate a Section 27 early deposit release. Our client lived interstate, and then yeah. And so just because of the timing of things, Section 27 is not a compulsory obligation on a purchaser. So the legislation allows you 28 days. You can make your objections. If they don't satisfy certain things, then that objection stands. But if you can satisfy those objections and the purchaser signs and sends it back under the 28 days, well, that's great. You know, that's a good outcome and a win for the vendor. But if they don't, then the law says on the 29th day, so long as all things have been complied with, you can get access to your money. So it's not as if they could hold it up or were holding it up indefinitely until settlement. So the agent and everyone was, firing around accusations and you know, getting quite sort of personal and nasty about it. And then he did his final inspection. And then on the, say, I think the seventh day, and on the day of settlement, he's gone back to the property and there was furniture, rubbish, garbage bags, the place, it was just strewn and littered with rubbish inside and out. Wow. So it was almost like they brought in a skip bin.
Yeah.
And when he sent through the photos, he sent through about 30 photos, it's just, if you look and you go, oh, this is such a bad experience for a purchaser. Yeah, it's really poor
interesting.
Form.
I mean, you talk about, you know, we have registers for bad tenants.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't it be nice to have a register for bad vendors?
People, just people in general. Just people there's in plenty of bad people.
Where you can shout them out in terms of what it looks like. All right. Well, we can talk all day about this stuff because it's quite fascinating. We need to move on to the next common issue. So what have we got?
Back-to-back settlements. So you buy and sell.
So synchronized settlements.
Yes, the old simultaneous settlements. This is where people need to get proper advice from both legal advice and also from their
finance people.
Because when you sell, you have to move out on that time. And then you buy, okay? Mm. If you do that on two different dates, how are you going to move out of your house?
And then
you're homeless for a week. You go, oops, I didn't realize I was settling a week later. But the two dates are the 20th and the 27th, for example. But worse is where you go and commit to a settlement on your purchase earlier than your sale. How are you going to fund that?
Mm.
Well, that's called a good bridging finance with your bank. That's what you're going to need.
Yeah.
So back-to-back settlements are probably the most stressful thing for couples to do, and they've always usually got young kids in tow.
Mm. Yeah. Mm.
And it's just, so we'll say to them, please don't settle on a Friday if it's a back-to-back.
Mm.
Let's settle on a Thursday, because if it falls over, you've got nowhere to live for 3 days and it does happen. So you need your sale to go through first.
Yeah, horrible.
And then if your purchase doesn't go through for whatever reason, at least you've still had your sale go through, but you are homeless, yes.
Mm. Yeah, and your bridging finance could be a couple of $1,000 a month, because it's like 7% a month.
So
it's
expensive.
It's not annualized interest. It's basically monthly interest. So it can be very expensive. So you need to look at that one.
All right. So title boundary discrepancies, chattels, final inspection issues, back-to-back settlements. What else?
Pre-purchase building inspections. Really important. Mm. I think from a contract point of view, rarely would we find something that is a showstopper, the real deal breaker. And it's not up to us to determine what's a deal breaker.
Mm.
We tell the client in black and white, simplistic, layman's terms, these are what these clauses mean. You then take that on board and say, well, does that fit with my requirements and my threshold or tolerance for these things? But structurally, you are paying for a title, yes, and there's a house on there. And if that house is $3 or $4 or $5 million or whatever it is, or $500,000, it's the biggest investment that you make. So why wouldn't you go and spend $300 or $400 or whatever and get a pre-purchase building inspection? Because a qualified building inspector can look at things that we can't see, that a contract will never, ever, ever tell me.
Mm.
Structurally, does it need restumping? One property needed about $50,000 to $70,000 of restumping. Other ones, some spouting wasn't connected and functional.
Yep.
So it was just going to go out there into the ether, and then where does it? How do you fix that? So
damp issues. And
they can be really small issues that are detected. But as Bryce said before, you've got major and minor, and keep it to the, it's got to be structural. So act in the spirit of a building inspection clause if you're operating under one of those. And that is, what is structural? There is no definition in the legislation.
Yeah.
To tell you what is major, what is minor, structure would sit under probably the building code.
Mm.
And I don't know, I'm guessing it starts in the foundations,
because
that's your structure, isn't it?
Yeah.
So where someone comes back and says, this is non-compliant building works, the pergola is an illegal structure, that is a red flag. Garage wall is unsafe, that is a red flag.
Illegal second dwelling, that is a red flag. Converted garage into a studio.
We've had a few of those. That was. I mean, that's a pearler. That was really, and the vendor was my client, so it provided me with a lot of amusement. But he had a shack, which was a bungalow, and then converted it into a second dwelling, which we didn't know about when we sold the property, because on our questionnaire he's come back and we don't actually ask how many dwellings have you, how many illegal dwellings
do you have
on, have you,
you're going to have to put it on your checklist.
Now we have to put on our checklist. And, you know, the checklist now has gone from probably 2 pages to 20. So he had converted that. He'd split the wires from the front house, which is highly illegal. So you've got lines running from the house to the back, and the bungalow goes lower.
Now open.
And then he rented out onto two different leases to the property.
Oh my God.
Yeah, two different occupants.
And he sold it as dual income.
Yeah, dual income, $50,000 income.
Woo-hoo.
So the buyers paid, I don't know, 500 grand, whatever it was. It was in Laylaw. And anyway, the purchasers, the good purchasers, obviously got legal advice, had their contracts reviewed, saw two properties there, and then went to council. So a number of inquiries were made at council. The council got onto this the day before auction, so on the Friday, and slapped the notice on.
Wow. Thank God for that.
So it was the vendor's responsibility.
Yep.
So when the notice came through, and that was the unfortunate situation for the purchasers in Richmond, it came 3 days after. So council came out. When I spoke with council, they said, we've had at least half a dozen purchasers ring up about this property and inquire. So when I went back to my client and presented the arguments of the purchaser who wanted to terminate the contract or get a $125,000 discount off the price, he was offended because he said...
What do you mean? What do you mean? My property is beautiful.
He goes, I have spent so much money turning this bungalow into a really good self-contained accommodation.
I did the electric work myself.
How dare they suggest that I have, you know, I've built this illegally. Like, there's a lot of blood, sweat and tears. And then the council showed me all the satellite photos from 2008, and you can see all of his progress of it. And I was just, like, having a good laugh. Unfortunate for him, of course, so I was very serious when I was talking to him.
Yeah.
And so he had to pull it down because it is an illegal structure under the building code. The power was a major breach and safety issue.
Yeah.
But also it was prohibited under the planning controls. So you couldn't even go and get a retrospective.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing with granny flats, that some councils, municipalities will grant you through a town planning permit the right to have a second dwelling, even though it's not under the planning.
Yep.
But once that granny moves on, dies, you have to remove the dwelling.
Because a lot of people say, in Victoria, can you get it as a granny flat? Because they're usually in New South Wales because you can do it. And the answer is no, because you've got to have that connection.
Because in New South Wales, it's a lot easier. Yeah. The planning process is simpler. They want to put more people in accommodation, so they're a little bit more flexible.
But
up
down
there.
Here, there's no blood. And, if there is blood and then they pass, you've got to rectify it again. Yeah. So
that comes back to the pre-purchase building inspection. That would have been identified for a potential purchaser as an illegal structure.
Very good. Now, is there anything to do with reviewing contracts is a constant...
All of the above. So it covers all of the above issues.
Mm.
You know, having a contract legally reviewed first will if you can't negotiate, and most of the time you can't negotiate the terms of the contract, at least you are aware of what your obligations, your rights are, what you're getting for your money, things that you should be doing like your due diligence of measuring the property or measuring the title or identifying that there are three titles to this property. Oh, there is a storage cage. Okay, well, it's not included on the title.
Yeah.
Or in the contract, I should say. So where is that storage cage? Because that happens a lot. People inadvertently forget to go, tell the conveyancer or lawyer, I'm selling it with a car park. Okay. Because sometimes they're not always on the amalgamated onto the one title. They could be separate titles, for example. So,
do you ever get anyone come to you? Because you know when you're buying an SMSF, do you do many SMSF
transactions? Lots and lots.
Because you can only buy a singly acquirable asset. So, for example, if you're buying an apartment that has an accessory unit,
yes.
Do they ask you to see if they can be separated? Because if they can't, they can't buy it in the SMSF.
It has to have, under the old way titles were under the Strata Act, the titles have to have a restriction.
Yeah.
So it has to be noted on title. This is a restricted accessory unit, for example, meaning that you cannot split and separate them. That's acceptable under the single acquirable asset test under the SIS Act. Where it's a subdivision of an off-the-plan, modern-day subs usually will have a part, so one title as to three or four parts. However, we had one which was an SMSF purchase, an established car park next door. This is on Fitzroy Street in St Kilda. And then the development was around the corner on Grey Street. So it sort of flanked or abutted the corner of the property.
So the access into the property.
Yeah, so it was an existing car park. So we could not get those titles together because one had already registered and existed for a long time. The other one was being developed. So what we did is we got the Macquarie Bank and their lawyers to accept what was a Section 173 agreement handed down, issued by council, that restricted the separation of car parks. So it was part of the planning approval process that developer could not sell those apartments without one car space each.
So that was
okay.
So it could be sold through Smurfs.
Yep.
Beautiful.
Yep.
Okay, that.
But very SMSF, the acceptable property or title, it's really important to have that checked.
Okay. Now, so what should a purchaser expect with a review? And I'm talking about time frames here. Because you're often, you get a lot of people that want to get it on Friday because they're going to auction the next day, which just puts your team under enormous pressure. How much headroom should you give your conveyancer solicitor for a contract
if
review?
If we had 24 hours leading time, we'd be happy.
Okay, cool.
Thursday is good. Unless it's an off the plan, I'm not going to do it.
What about most conveyances? Like, look, in a rule of thumb, 7 days, please.
Well, out of a recent catch-up I had with 12, 13 of my colleagues in the same association that I'm in, as for contract reviews, I think there was only myself and one other that both charged and did written. So the others will do a verbal and they all said, I don't have time to do a review. I don't have time to spend the time that you do, Nicole. Okay, that's fine. So, but do you think that the client is relying on legal advice to that contract? Because it's not about what you're telling the client. I've had a quick look. It all looks fine. Okay, what do you mean it looks fine? Which part looks fine? What does that mean to me?
When the proverbial hits the fan, who's liable? No, you told me.
Our professional indemnity insurer, because I've taken this to our association, to the president, because it's a big gripe of mine that you've got conveyancers out there who give free legal advice on a contract, but they argue that it's not legal advice because they're just having a quick look for the client. It doesn't make sense. They've come to you. They're not going to the milk bar down the road. Can you have a look at this?
Yeah, it looks all right to me.
Yeah. It looks fine to me, yeah.
The bush lawyer in you. It's looking pretty good.
Yeah, so I, my view is that the advice is as good as what you pay for it. And when a client comes to us, which we get quite a lot, can you have a quick look at this? I will usually respond with, sure, which part of the 84 pages did you want me to just look at? Did you want me to look at page 2 to 20? Because that, I mean, I could do that fairly quickly. Or do you want me to ignore 2 to 20 and I'll just go straight to 60 to 84? Or, I have a bit of cheek. I have a bit of a cheeky moment with them.
That's good.
And then they go, and one client said, I don't actually know the answer to that. And I said, well, let me help you, son. Anyway, so sometimes you can get the...
Well, tell us what you actually said.
You got a fire-up conveyance here, right? She fired up.
Yeah, I'm grumpy Gloria sometimes.
Remember at the top of it, I said she's a shy girl?
Oh, yeah. But she knows her stuff.
Yeah, so stuff. I just think with contract reviews, it is... Yes, it is very important to get the legal advice. And I also think equally a building pre-purchase inspection is important because the structural nature can what cost you a lot as well.
All right, so things people don't think about when they're buying a property. So you've talked about title boundary discrepancies, chattels, final inspection issues and disputes, back-to-back settlements, obtaining pre-purchase building inspections, having it reviewed. Is there anything else?
Can I throw it before you do the last one? If you're going anywhere at JV, because more and more people are looking at JVs, you know, brother-sister type stuff, have a contract in place as well. In terms of decisions
very
around,
good. Yes.
So
we'll talk
more about that before. But I just thought I'd throw this in because this is the legal section today. I see too many people. Oh, we're brother and sister. We don't need an agreement. Everything will work out. All right. There's money involved. So I'll leave it at that.
Till the new husband comes on the scene or the new boyfriend.
Number seven. What have we got, Nick?
Okay. Land tax.
Yes.
So adjustable items at settlement, as a purchaser, you pay outgoings.
Yes.
And they can include, not limited to, council, water, and owner's corporation, land tax, rent is usually adjusted. Well, it's usually adjusted if it's a leased property.
Yeah.
In my experience of late, I have seen a number of substantial deals such in the sort of circa 4 mil.
Yep.
Where I've had a couple of reviews done. They were overseas based, so they're foreign residents that own property here.
Mm.
It's an investment. You can't hold it as your PPR. Mm-hmm. Land tax is exempt on PPRs, principal place of residence.
Mm, correct.
On investments, it's not exempt. And where the land value or unimproved in value exceeds $250,000, then land tax usually starts in Victoria. It usually starts, and this is collected by the state revenue office.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a state-based land tax, and it is a huge kicker for the state coffers. I think land tax is second behind stamp duty.
So stamp duty
second best business behind mortgage.
No, so it's number one is GST. So GST is
for the state.
Well, yes. It's collected. It's collected nationally, but it's paid to the states. And then it's stamp duty, then it's payroll tax, and then land tax. So they're the top four. That's basically how they put our services.
Well, land tax is pretty expensive on a $4 or $5 million property in Toorak, and this is where these two properties were. So my client, who actually happens to be a lawyer, not in contract law, he's an in-house counsel for a large corporation, he gets contracts. So our contract reviews were bullet point sharp. I don't have to have the fluffy conversation with him.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, buddy, this is what's going to happen on this. Mm-hmm. Oh, great. This is fantastic. Mm-hmm. You know, and off we go.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're talking to someone at a different level and he didn't understand land tax. So, well, because it's not, he doesn't deal in land tax or contracts and adjustments and things like that. He deals in big, big contracts. So I had a look at the two properties, and one... it was a PPR. Sorry, it wasn't a PPR, but I knew it was a foreign resident and they didn't have a land tax certificate in. So just through a few powers of deduction, speaking to the council, finding out what their unimproved value was or site value, that then tells me how the state revenue office value it.
Yeah, yeah.
So the certificate wasn't in there. And by its omission, tells me something's dodgy.
Yeah, yep.
You know, you're trying to hide the fact that we have to adjust this. So I think that was about... $20,000 on the first property.
Wow.
That's the annual land tax because the land value was about $4 million, $3 million or something. Yep. And then, so his pro rata proportionate share was about $13,000 because this is late last year, he had to have a 90 day settlement. So he was always going to settle in February ish of 2018.
Yep.
So he's going to pay on a calendar year, which is how it's charged, 11 months of that $20,000. And then the second property, the same thing, but the land tax certificate was in there and we knew that it was about a $13,000. So he hadn't quite picked up on what all the special clauses that I drafted for the first one, which he didn't successfully win at auction. The second one came around, I had a look and I said, I'm going to draft some clauses for the land tax. I said, these are non-negotiable.
Yeah.
And because you're going to pay $13,000. He just said, that's the best $400 I've spent.
Well, that is a good $400, yeah. Isn't it?
For I know.
Enormous value. Yeah.
So land tax can be payable. It's a land tax of the rich, the land rich, and it is unfair, but that's my opinion, that I don't think it's fair that a purchaser should pay for a vendor's
Let's bring it down into mum and dad territory here. What we're still saying is if an investor is selling one of their investment properties, divesting from it, and there's a land tax due to them, even if they're first home buyers looking to come into the property, they could be up for land tax.
Yeah,
and
for the other first home buyer, he's got to pay it.
What about unpaid GST? Have you had any dealings in that space?
Well, the laws are going to probably change July 1,
yeah.
And I think that is a minefield. We might, because it's such an exciting topic, we might save that to another time.
Love it. I'll tell you what I've learned from this podcast. Isn't it, like, we've been doing property for 20 plus years, right? But every time, we were even asking questions, and we were even going, oh.
Yeah.
So that just shows you specialisation. Mm. Specialist to do the specialist role. You cannot be a generalist when it comes to hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars. You need to bring your team of professionals together because they all know what they know about their specialty. And that's why, you know, there is no question that you go to the top end of town to get the best advice you can when there's so much money involved.
Yeah, well, as a buyer's agent, Ben, I look at, you know, scores and scores of contracts, but I never pretend or I never do give advice about that. And I look at scores and scores of properties and I know what stumps and wiring, but I will never put...
No.
You put it out to the people who are experts at that. You put it out to the people that are experts at this.
Yeah, you bring it all together and you explain it to them. And so, you know, working with other professionals is critical in the process of bringing the property story together.
How good was that?
Thank you.
Fabulous. Fantastic.
The most common mistakes and the costs involved.
I know.
So
there's some good stuff there. And as I said, episode 107, Ben, is when we talked to Nicole last.
Yes.
And there's some really good stuff
in there.
There
as
backstory,
well.
How she got involved in the industry. Yeah.
And some tips and tricks around conveyancing as well. So it's
absolutely
well worth a listen.
Yeah. Very good. Okay, my life hack today might help you. We were talking before we push record that there's a couple of Channel 9 shows that you like to watch.
Wait a minute, and you, for that matter, just for the record.
Well,
not Ben.
So here's the deal, right? I've got an Apple TV at home, and it's got 10Play on it, right? Automatically preloaded. So if someone knows how to actually get all the other stations on there, they let me know. But for the time being, if there's a Channel 9 program that I want to watch... What I do is I put it on, say, 9 now on my phone, and then I just push it up to the Apple TV. So I can effectively watch replays of commercial TV on Channel 9 shows that I've missed by just beaming it from my phone up to the telly via my Apple TV.
Yeah. So, and any new phone.
Without ads?
They do put a few
no,
in.
No.
But you can fast forward and all that sort of stuff, get to different spots. So if you're missing the shows, Ben, because I don't like sitting there watching it.
How old's your TV?
It doesn't matter about the TV. It's about how old's the Apple TV, because it's just the box.
No, but the TVs actually have the apps on them. So you don't have to push it through Apple television.
Mate, I haven't built the Taj Mahal like you with the new smart TVs. Mate, I'm still
the TV,
just...
I still
get up and I turn the dial and I push the button off.
Or if you've got a Google Chrome key, same sort of thing. All of that sort of built into the Chrome key.
So does your latest TV have all of 9 Now in it, 10 Play?
Yeah, all of that.
Well, I'm talking to the people that sort of... I'm talking to the everyday Australians.
Yeah, but if you buy the Chrome key and you don't have the smart television, the Chrome key basically goes in, like it's like a little USB that sits in there and it basically makes your television a smart TV. So you don't have to push it through.
Why didn't you tell me that before the life hack and look at it with the life hack?
Because I wanted to walk
there
down
you go,
the Bunsen Island.
High five. Oh, look at you two pack hunters over there. Hey, please, me and Nicole will stick together.
Is it called a Chrome key? Thank you.
Ben, I just want to ask though, smart TVs.
Yes.
When do you have time to watch television?
Oh, here we go.
So,
and it assumes you're smart. So.
Well, you did say before, intellectual people do not watch the reality junk that's on the television.
No, I only watch Auntie. I've told you that. You know, I get my social fix on Auntie.
Your social fix on Auntie.
A bit of Netflix. I watch a lot of documentaries on Netflix. This is not anything about me.
Yeah.
But the point, normally I'm exhausted by Friday afternoons, Friday nights. So Friday nights I have a bit of TV and I'm a bit of a home person, so Saturday nights I might
You're
watch
getting on
a bit
in
of
your
TV.
Years now.
Yeah. I'm, come on, keep going. Absolutely. Come on. Okay.
Yes, I am getting on. You know, there's you know, the body mass index is you know, a little bit shaky.
I don't think body mass, the BMI, is an accurate assessment.
There's another podcast. GST, that's
BMI. Did you know?
Did you know, Ben?
All right, just a quick one on the did you know. I just wanted to just focus in on the number of properties that are, that sort of mum and dads bring to the table versus the number of properties that the public housing supplies. So if we're going to be talking about changes to, you know, legislation around negative gearing and so forth, I just thought this was an interesting stat that that people should know. And it is a little bit old, but just to give you in the context, in December, the December quarter of 2015, right, in terms of houses, this is nationally, the public sector bought 395 new dwellings to market to look after social housing. The private sector, there was 28,971. In terms of units, they bought 405, and in the public sector, in the private sector, 16,970. So if you sort of put that into context, that the government sector is providing less than 5% of new dwellings coming to market. Mum and dad investors are basically providing the rental accommodation to look after these people. And we all know, I'll just follow on, there's some snippets that I got, you know, last year that I thought were interesting. A waiting list for public housing in New South Wales, over 60,000. Housing repairs of bills that need to be done, 300 million, right? And what have they spent in the last 3 years? 2.2 million. Now, this is from the Sydney Morning Herald 2017, and the waiting list was the ABC in March of 2017. Now, in Victoria, here's an example, the waiting list for public housing in Melbourne alone is nearing 40,000, and that was again in May, in The Age, May 17, 2017. It's a worry for me.
Does the Labor Party know about that?
Well, they think that their policy is a solution for that because everyone will buy new. But the reality is the new properties don't necessarily give the better returns. Mm. So we've talked about that before, but I just thought it's just interesting to note that if mum and dad investors abandon property investment and the government then work out, holy crap, and this is the state governments and territory governments, work out, we're going to have to build all this new public housing. They've got no money. Who's going to supply the money? Well, what's, we talked about the highest revenue generators. So are they going to increase GST? You bet they are. Are they going to increase stamp duty, land taxes? You bet they are. So it just puts pressure on the state government purses. So the robbing of the, you know, this is what I keep saying about robbing Peter to pay Paul. In terms of the federal government, well, they're getting the receipts around, you know, income tax. But you know, if there's not enough money flowing through the states and mum and dad investors abandon property because it's no longer as, you know, as successful to invest in, who's going to pick up? Well, everyone's going to pay. Everyone's going to pay in terms of extra taxes to be able to supply. And they are inefficient at managing property. They're bloody terrible at it. Every time a new person, and they have to have set rules, right? They've got all these regulations. So if someone lives in the property for a year and they move out, they've got to repaint it and retile it. It's just costly. So we do a better job at running it compared to the very, very small percentage of people who may do the wrong thing in terms of landlords who are tight asses and they basically, you know, don't look after their tenants. But the vast majority of mum and dad investors want their tenants to be happy because they keep staying there and looking after the property. There you go.
Yeah.
Did not know that,
Ben.
Did not know that. Thank you. There you go.
Very good. But terrific to have you on as always. It's always full of energy, full of information.
Nicole Fade from Accord Conveyancing, a little plug there.
Yes.
In the show notes.
We'll definitely have your details in the show notes. Yep. And if you're thinking of buying, you should definitely reach out to Nicole.
Thanks for the invite, guys.
Pleasure. Always good to have you on, mate. Until next week.
Knowledge is empowering, but only if you act on it.
All right. See you next week.